This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Dan Hurley. If you thought that the push and pull over the city budget was over, you're wrong. When the city of Cincinnati closed its books on fiscal 2018, there was about a $5.6 million surplus. How to spend that money has reignited the struggle between those who want to move up the start date for the next police recruit class and those who want to fund closing the health gap and certain economic development organizations. To talk about that familiar struggle and other political news, we are joined today by Cincinnati Business Courier reporter and columnist Chris Wetterig and WVXU City Hall reporter Jay Hanselman. If you'd like to join our discussion, call 513-419-7100 or email us at talk@wvxu.org. Jay, Chris, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Jay.
Thank you.
Back in June, when council was going through the budget process, let's call it that, everybody knew sitting there that this supposed closeout budget, as it's called, was going to happen and it was going to be another sort of chance to go around on some of this. Is that right? I mean, this isn't a surprise to anybody.
No, not at all. There is always, usually, unless things are really lean, there's always what is referred to as a carryover balance. And I think there was even some things funded in the budget with the thought that there would be a carryover balance, and those items were put in the budget, but the money would have to come from the carryover. So, yeah, there was no – this is not surprising.
Okay. So, Chris, one of the issues here is that the police chief has said, we've got this money. Back in June, you pushed off the start of a recruit class to April. We need to move that up. Why is it important to the chief?
Well, there's a lot of retirements in the department right now, and there was some kind of historical anomaly where they hired a bunch of people, you know, 30 years ago, roughly, and those people are coming up on retirement. And so the concern apparently is that they will fall below 1,000 officers sometime potentially by March. And for some reason, that's a red line for the chief and the mayor certainly as well. I'm not sure why that's such a magical number, but the warning that they sent the council members was that, you know, look, we're going to have to pay a lot of overtime out. And in some cases, paying overtime is more expensive than hiring additional officers, especially those that will be at the low end of the pay grade, obviously. And so that's why he wants to move that recruit class up. That conflicts with some other spending priorities that council members have, including the politically controversial Center for Closing the Health Gap. And there's some other less controversial things that kind of just were hanging out there. Centrifuge and Cincy Tech, the two tech accelerators, they also need funding. And that stems from the fact that the billboard tax the council passed has had a restraining order slapped on it by Common Pleas Judge Kurt Hartman.
If I could just quickly there, and Chris can jump in on this too. The interesting thing is part of the way that they balance the budget that they have is because originally the city manager or the city administration had proposed starting the recruit class on January the 1st, and they actually moved it back to April the 1st to save money to spend on other programs. And I don't recall the police chief or the police department raising any red flags in June that this was going to be a problem.
No, and that kind of points to, you know, what I think some people down at City Hall, you know, would say, oh, well, this is a little political gamesmanship, because the mayor, of course, has feuded for a long time with the Center for Closing the Health Gap CEO Dwight Tillery, the former mayor of Cincinnati. They were once political allies. It's important people know that. And they had a falling out several years ago. And Tillery ended up supporting Councilwoman Simpson in the 2017 election. And, you know, cynical people might think that that might be why the police recruit class needs to be moved up all of a sudden.
Well,
but I'm not saying that cynicism is justified.
Before we get to the closing the health gap and the political overlay on this whole thing, I want to stick with the police question itself.
Yeah.
So is the fact that there is the financial implications of falling below 1,000.
Right.
You know, because of overtime. But
it raises that traditional question we always get to is, what's the right number of police for a city this size? And how do we measure ourselves? And does this have questions, real significant questions about safety? And, you know, is that at the heart of this, or we can get to the political side here in a minute?
No, we should talk about that. You know, when they've done benchmarks, I think that, and Jay, correct me if I'm wrong here, but I haven't seen one of these studies in a while, but, you know, Cincinnati has more police than per capita or on a per resident basis than other cities do. You know, other peer cities, I suppose, is the more precise way of doing it.
Measured in terms of population.
Correct. Right. And, you know, I've asked about that over the years, and you know, some of the reasons they cite is the city's kind of bizarre shape, right? If you think about the shape of the city, we have those long lines out to Sailor Park, and we have another line kind of out on the East End a little bit. And the city, you know, it's kind of hard to, you know, have a police force when you have to staff, you know, you have to staff a, you know, some officers out in those places when, you know, it's kind of a weird shape of the city that they're dealing with. That's one reason. And, you know, I think there's political, you know, stuff going on at that. I mean, the mayor has long wanted a robust police force going back to his days on city council. And so, you know, that's kind of just the overview of that issue. Jay, I don't know what you would.
Yeah, Jay, you've been around City Hall.
And I was going to say, back at the early 2000s when now Mayor Cranley was council member Cranley, there was a push to add, I can't remember if it was 50 or 100 police officers, and I distinctly remember that Tom Stryker said, yeah, I'll take them, who was the police chief at the time, but I don't think that he even necessarily thought that, you know, that was necessary. And the number, I think, at one time, I think was quoted this week, they got up to 1,135 officers, and then it's kind of drifted off that the approved complement right now is 1,057.
One thing that somebody pointed out to me over at City Hall was that, you know, the people that are retiring, they're not necessarily the beat cops that are on the street, right? Because those tend to be younger men and women.
Probably in the first 5 to 8 years of
sure. So those aren't service. The people that are leaving. You have people who, you know, might be detectives, might be, you know, working desk jobs, those types of things. And so there was kind of a question of, well, you know, are those folks so essential? Like, are these retirements going to cause police officers who walk the beat on the street that people see, who are in patrol cars, are those the cops? Are we going to be having less of those on the street because of this? And I think that that's a question that's probably going to get asked at Monday's joint meeting of the Budget and Finance and Public Safety Committees at City Hall.
Jay, what's your view? I mean, the funding of the Closing the Health Gap is controversial. As Chris was saying, Mayor Cranley and Dwight Tillery have really been at it for the last couple of years. Mayor Cranley just doesn't want this in the budget. You know, where's that going to go? Because there is support on council for that.
I think that is going to depend on how many council members vote yes for the Center for Closing the Health Gap. What came out on Monday, there were 5 votes in favor. 5 is not enough to withstand a mayoral veto. It takes 6 votes to override a veto. And I know that the original plan that came out Monday, they tried to lump everything, carryover budget, into one great big ordinance, because then that way the mayor doesn't have a line item veto. So he either has to approve the whole thing or veto the whole thing. And I'm sure that's probably where we're headed with the police. I'm told that they're going to try to find a way to fund moving up the police recruit class, and there will be the money for the Center for Closing the Health Gap. That will all be in one great big ordinance, and then it'll be up to the mayor to decide, you know, does he stand that, no way, the Center for Closing the Health Gap is not going to get any money as long as I'm mayor, and he'll have to, you know, veto the whole thing, and they'll have to start over.
And what level are we talking about funding Closing the Health Gap at this point? Because this has gone – there's all kinds of numbers that, where this has been in the past several months.
That's an important
part. I was going to say that's part of the interesting. In June, they were approved for $550,000, and most of that was coming – Chris can correct me if I'm wrong – but from the billboard tax.
Right.
Since the billboard tax got put on hold, then that $550,000 was in question – And then Monday, as they were discussing this, they were giving them the $550,000 and adding an additional $150,000 on top of that.
And that's important to note because you're probably asking yourself, how did they get this through over the mayor's veto in the first place? Well, they had six votes for it. But when they have added this additional money, David Mann, Councilman David Mann, has come off. He is not going to vote for $700,000 for the health cap. He was willing to vote for $550,000, but he raised some concerns on Monday. He wanted to hear more about accountability of the job performance that the group is doing. And so he has said publicly, at least at this point, that he's not going to vote for $700,000.
I want to raise one more question, one more area, and that is the whole question of black-owned businesses and over the Rhine. There is a lot of sensitivity around this, and there are some new commitments, Chris, around the need for this and agreements. What's going on here?
You know, there's an interesting development earlier this week with the Cincinnati Center City Development Corporation. They're known colloquially as 3CDC. They and two other developers, the Model Group and
Urban Sites.
Urban Sites. They have committed to leasing the majority of their space in the future to black-owned businesses. And that's a significant step because, you know, 3CDC in particular has been getting some criticism about the redevelopment over the Rhine and bringing in more and more wealthy residents there, and kind of been accused of making it a playground for the wealthy there. And, you know, they really, I think 3CDC's record is way more complex than that. They have built tons of, you know, affordable housing in the neighborhood that's been embedded in their apartments that they've built as well. And so not exactly meeting the needs of affordable housing in the city, but they have contributed some of that. And I think that's kind of an underreported thing. But anyway, so the idea is that and Greg Landsman and Tamaya Dinar, both city council members, were both involved in this effort. You know, they wanted to make Over the Rhine the most diverse business environment, business district, I suppose, in the city in terms of ownership of these businesses. And so they've come out and made that commitment. Findlay Market's also involved, although I'm not clear that Findlay Market is making the same commitment because many of their spaces are already filled. And so this is kind of an interesting step forward. The question is whether they can accomplish it or not.
Yeah. And this is going to take some funding, so the banks have to be involved too.
Right, right.
So this is not an easy
task. It's not like you can just pop up and, you know, say, here's a business, we're putting it in there, right? There's a lot of steps between that.
So a lot of things happening, and we should watch City Hall next early next week. Is
Definitely.
That right, Jay?
That's early next week, and then if whatever is going to happen with the budget would come to the full council on Wednesday.
Okay. Well, Jay Hanselman, thanks for being with us this afternoon. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Dan Hurley. This week, the Siena College, on behalf of the New York Times, released the first public poll on the nationally watched race between Congressman Steve Chabot and challenger Aftab Pierval in the Ohio 1st Congressional District. To talk about that poll and the campaign in general, we are joined by Cincinnati Business Courier reporter and columnist Chris Wetterich and Cincinnati Enquirer reporter Scott Wortman.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, good to have you back. Chris, this is the first public poll. This doesn't mean this is the first poll. There's a lot of private polls these guys have been doing on their own. What are the basic takeaways here?
Right. And we've gotten some peeks at stuff in the private polling, but not – they haven't shown us the guts of it. So it's like
– and that's very common.
It's common, but it's I won't write a story about it unless I get to see what's in it. What's in all of it, and they won't show it to us, but we can talk about it as well. So the Siena College poll that the New York Times has been doing, they by the way, are doing a really interesting thing where they live poll people on the New York Times website, and you can see the poll being conducted. And so I was watching a little bit of this over the weekend as they were doing it. But the takeaway from the poll is that Chabot is leading Pierval 50% to, I believe, 40. It's either 40 or 41. There's not a lot of good news in that for Pierval, and lots of good news for Chabot. Mostly the headline that I thought the main takeaway that I had from the poll is that, you know, Chabot is leading men big time. He's got 57% of men. But he's not doing that bad with women either. He's only 3 or 4 points down from Purval on women, and that has been really key in other congressional races.
47% to 44%
right.
is the only the split with women, which
right.
is that is not this huge suburban white women
correct.
Break that's been talked about.
And Purval needs a huge, huge gender gap with women in order to make up for this. And independence. Purval is also winning independence, but again, only by 3 or 4 points. And so it just doesn't – it's not looking good for him at this point.
Yeah, and that's the takeaway I've heard from people too, the fact that even though he has – more support among women, the fact that that's not really doing him much good, that should be a cause of concern for him.
And how trustworthy, how much
is the poll?
How much faith do you put in this poll? They polled about 503 people.
It's got about a margin of error of 9%, plus or minus 4.6 on either side. So which is the margin that Chabot's leading by in the poll. So I would still agree with what a lot of the prognosticators have said, that it's still a toss-up, but it does look promising for Chabot, the results of this poll, and that AFTAB still has an uphill battle to climb in this district.
Well, I think you can say that going into this race, people knew this was an uphill battle. This is not right. an easy district.
Yeah.
So the fact that this is an uphill battle shouldn't be a surprise, right?
No. It's a Republican gerrymandered district. And when you talk about the reliability of polling, you know, about one out of every – when you do a scientific poll, which this one was, it interviewed 503 people, and that's pretty standard for a congressional race like that. You know, about one out of every 20 polls is bad, is a bad poll. It just doesn't – the results aren't good, and but I tend to not think this is one of them, just because of the across the board, you know, bad news. I think for Purval.
My takeaway covering this race all year, as the months have gone on, it seemed like the momentum was on Purval's side. You saw him rising in the minds of the National Party, the DCCC, and. This poll at least shows how much, you know, how accurate it is remains to be seen, but it shows that maybe that momentum wasn't as much as it appeared to be.
Or maybe it peaked.
Yeah, or maybe it peaked.
You know, he's been getting beat up on TV ads, you know, by both the Chabot campaign and the Congressional Leadership Fund, which is a Speaker Paul Ryan-backed PAC, and that may be having an effect. I just think the district is inherently Republican. I mean, it's got all of Warren County, which is right of Reagan, really. And, you know, the one bright spot is the New York Times showed you the dots where people they polled were. And the one thing that the Democrats told me earlier in this process was they thought that they were going to do okay around the city of Mason, because there's a lot of Indian immigrants, Asian American immigrants there, and they thought that people would vote for them there. You did see quite a few more blue dots around Mason than I would have thought. I grew up in Westchester, right across the Butler Warren Road from mm-hmm. Mason, so you know, you can see some of that changing demographic there in the dots that they showed you on who they polled there. So.
Scott, you wrote an article about the other race in mm-hmm. our area, other congressional race. Question you pose, can Jill Shiller shock the world
yes.
in the second congressional district in her race against Brad Winstrup? Can she?
It's very unlikely, but this is the first big challenge that Brad Winstrup has faced since he was elected to Congress in 2012, and before his predecessor, Gene Schmidt, she had some close races with Democrats in that district. And because of redistricting, they put the portion of Warren County that was in that district in the Chabot district to shore his district up. So it's actually probably more Democratic than it was when Gene Schmidt was representing the second congressional district. So there's a credible case to be made that it could be closer than a lot of people think. It's still a very conservative, very Republican district, but there is a chance. And most experts I talked to said there is an outside chance that she could pull it off.
How much how much blue wave, how much women's year does she need?
A lot.
To pull it off.
Yeah, I mean.
And to what extent
It all needs to go right for her to make this happen.
And to what extent in that district is Claremont County playing the same role as Warren County in the first congressional district? I mean, it's really that solid Republican wall.
And I would argue it's not just Claremont County there. You have Adams County, Scioto County. This was all heavy Trump country. There is a caveat when the further east you get, it's very Appalachian and historically Democrat. So it might not be exactly analogous to Warren County, but it all has to fall into place for Jill. But again, there is that chance.
It needs to be a blue tsunami, not a blue wave, in order for Jill Schiller to win. I mean, I think that she'd be like one of the last Democrats in terms of their majority, in terms of, you know, all of the races that the Democrats have targeted. You know, I think she's a kind of a second tier race for them nationally, and it just seems very, very unlikely to me.
I did find it interesting that Brad Wenstrup has launched an ad attacking Jill Schiller, because that does give her more name recognition by just getting her name out there. So I don't know if that indicates that they are seeing her as at least a credible threat.
To what extent is she building a foundation that she can build on 2 years? I know that no candidate wants to hear that you're building for the future.
They're always in it to win this year, right?
They're in it to win this year. But the reality is, how much is it she's building a foundation that she could build on for 2 years from now?
Yeah, I mean, she is definitely a credible candidate, and she is popular among her base. She has Ted Strickland, the former governor, campaigning for her. He came to some fundraisers here. I think he was in, I think it was Claremont County or somewhere in the outlying counties of the district the other day at a campaign event for her. So she is making connections, and the people that like her really seem to like her.
We've got a call that's come in, and I want to make sure that we get to it. And it sort of takes us back to the other race, but that's okay. And we can go both ways here. Jimmy, what's your question today?
Dan, how you doing?
I'm doing great, Jimmy.
That's wonderful. Hey, thanks for taking my call. I'm a disabled American military veteran. And ever since Casey and Chad have been in there, we veterans have suffered. We suffered tremendously in the state of Ohio. And my question is, while you're on the radio and all these people are listening, at the VA hospital, all my fellow veterans, VAV, American Legion, VFWs, I want you to ask these people, just tell us, what's the record that Steve Shabby can show what he has done, him and Casey and DeWine? What have they done to show, provide how they have cut the toughest zone and taken away medical, transportation, education, recreational benefits, and cut the veterans to the neck?
Okay, Jimmy, I want to make sure we have time to answer your question and respond to your question. So I think this is interesting in terms of the fact that the VA has been a struggle for the past administration in Washington, the current administration in Washington. And where has somebody like Steve Shabbat been on that issue? I mean, we have a major VA hospital here.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I haven't heard him address it. I honestly don't know where he stands on that.
Yeah, I don't either. And frankly, you haven't seen a lot of public appearances by either candidate where this issue could be asked about. And yeah, they did finally schedule some debates for the meat of the election season down in the middle of October. So, I think it's something that they ought to be asked about.
And Steve Shabbat, for last several months, I haven't really seen too much of him out in the community, so I don't know. I don't know where he stands on that issue. No.
Do you see Pierval out in the community?
A bit more, because he's got to make himself known. So yeah,
I'll tell you this: neither candidate sends us their public schedules.
Yeah.
So
that's interesting.
It would be nice to be able to show up and see them interact with voters. It's not happening. And, I think a lot of congressional candidates view that as too risky, to But, you know, in the old days when these, you know, in the old days of like 4 years ago or 5 years ago or 6 years ago, you used to get some of that stuff. It's notable. It's a high risk environment for them.
A lot of it is invite only on both sides. So, you don't necessarily see them, you know, ringing doorbells.
Which is a different from the city council and mayor's race led in 2017, man. They went old school in terms of how they ran the race. Yeah.
Yep. Well, Chris and Scott, once again, thank you for being here on Friday. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Dan Hurley. A huge backlog of DNA testing at the Kentucky Crime Lab, 19% of which involves charges of sexual assault, is delaying justice for thousands of people in the Commonwealth. We are joined this afternoon by WCPO reporter Hillary Lake, who filed an iTeam report this week about the situation. To join our discussion, call 513-419-7100 or email us at talk@wvxu.org. Hillary, welcome to Cincinnati Edition.
Thanks for having me, Dan.
What's the scope of the problem here?
Well, the scope of the problem here is, you know, we were contacted by a woman who says she was raped in Northern Kentucky, and she told me that the detective looking into her case told her that it was going to be 15 months before they got the results of her rape kit back. And I heard that and I was like, that can't be possible. This is a very serious allegation. Why would there be this kind of a delay? And I called the crime lab, and sure enough, the director told me, cases going back past June of this year, there's a longer delay, 15 to 8 months. They've gotten it down to 8 months, and they're trying to shoot for 90 days. But the scope of the problem is that these are not just rape cases. These are murders, assaults, any case that needs DNA testing to be done. And right now, there's about almost 2,300 cases that are waiting to be processed. Part of the issue, too, is that once the cases are processed, if there is a DNA hit, that's not the end of the line for the testing. There is additional testing that has to be done to make sure that the result is what it is. All of that has to be entered into a federal database, and it takes some time. But compounding the problem, or causing the delay, I guess, is that there has not been enough staff to deal with the amount of cases that are coming into that lab. And there are reasons for the staffing issues.
One of the interesting things about your report is that you name one person. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it's the person who initially contacted mm-hmm. you or not, is it?
It is.
Okay. So Tracy Jackson.
Yes.
You don't normally identify a potential rape victim.
Yes, that's correct.
And but she felt she wanted to go public.
Right.
And but her situation is not unique, and she falls into this great mass of other people. It's also the people on the other side, those who are accused.
Yeah.
So trials can't go forward, right?
Trials can't go forward. We, as you mentioned, we named Tracy. We had her permission. We interviewed her on camera. She did not want us to conceal her identity in any way. She kind of wanted to be the face of this because she wanted this story out there that there is this delay and that there are ordinary people like her who have had something horrible happen to them, who are waiting sort of in this limbo, in her case, 15 months until anything can be done with her case because they're waiting on these results.
Well, and one of the points that I think is interesting that you make is that there are almost 2,300
uh-huh.
cases, as I understand it, but that there may be more than one thing to analyze.
Sure.
So you identify 20,000 possible individual pieces of evidence mm-hmm. that you have to look for DNA in those 2,300 cases.
Right. So in doing the reporting for this story, we actually went to the crime lab on two different days where we were able to witness lab analysts going through DNA testing. In one case, it was not a rape case. It was some other kind of case. I don't even know what kind of case it was, but mm-hmm. we were able to be in there as the lab analyst was opening up envelopes and doing what he needed to do. But then they also showed us with sample rape kits what they do. So how that process actually works. And there's a victim rape kit and a suspect rape kit. And both of them have, I don't know, at least 10 different types of things that need to be collected and tested. And so you take that and you multiply it by the 2,300, the number of cases that are out there. The lab director, she just estimated that there's something like 20,000 different individual pieces of evidence that need to be analyzed.
So first off, this isn't NCIS.
Right.
Where it happens overnight.
Right.
Or shorter.
Right.
And and secondly, when you were in that lab, mm-hmm. and you have identified, and the people who run the lab have identified a lack of staff, mm-hmm. did you see open workstations where people, they just didn't have the staff there, or is it just they've got it filled, but they're swamped?
There, I think it's a combination of both. While we were there, yes, we did see open workspaces, but I can't for sure say that it's a result of they don't have the bodies to fill those spaces, because we were there in the afternoon. And I believe most of the lab techs or the analysts come in very early in the morning, 6, 7, 8 o'clock, and we were there 3 or 4 in the afternoon. So that would be around the time a lot of the shifts had already ended. Mm-hmm. What I can tell you about the staffing is that a year ago, June, July, and August of 2017, they had 22 lab techs or analysts. And this year, same time period, they have 32. That doesn't, I mean, it's 10 more people. And they were able to, the difference with 10 people, they were able to get through maybe an extra 150 cases compared this time last year. But the staffing issue, it's kind of like when you're hiring firefighters or police officers. You can't just hire somebody and put them to work the next day. There's a certain amount of training that has to go through. And the training for this job, these jobs, takes about a year. And there's it's just like with other, you know, police, fire jobs, investigator jobs, where sometimes you don't make it all the way through the training. And then your bosses determine, you know what, you're just not a good fit for us. Mm-hmm. And that's happened in combination with the salaries that the Kentucky State Police Crime Lab pays. In some cases, it's a $20,000 difference. You can come up here to Hamilton County and make $20,000 more and not even have to move. And that happened in at least one case that I was told about, where somebody had a job down there at, you know, in Frankfort, and then came up here to Hamilton County. And so it's about retention, and it's about Kentucky not paying high enough wages. I believe that that state lawmakers last year did give them a $4,000 pay bump, but they hadn't had a pay bump in years, and that's not going to go very far.
So it was make up,
yep,
to a certain level, but still not catch up,
yep,
to the competitors.
Yeah.
Now, we all know that in Ohio, there's been a lot of attention to clearing these sorts of test, mm-hmm, in the Ohio crime lab. How does Kentucky compare with Ohio, with Indiana, with close,
sure,
states?
Well, and I want to make it very clear that the backlog that we're talking about in Kentucky is current cases. These are current cases. These were not part of that original rape kit backlog that was discovered in most states. That is cleared up in Kentucky. That is also cleared up in Ohio. In Ohio, the average turnaround for current cases is about 24 days. That's according to the Attorney General's office. There is a state law that all new DNA rape kit cases do have to be tested. Compare that to the 8 to 15 months and even the 90-day where they're supposed to be at in Kentucky. That's still a big difference. In Indiana, their rape kit back, the original rape kit, those latent kits that have been sitting around, I don't remember the number off the top of my head, but there's several thousand of them. They have not tested all of those yet. There is no state law that says that they're supposed to do so. There's also no state law that says that they're supposed to test any new kits coming in. But the state police laboratory told me that their average turnaround is 75 days. So again, a lot less than Kentucky.
A lot less than Kentucky.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a sense that Kentucky legislature is ready to put more resources behind this?
You know, that's a tough call, and that's sort of the follow-up. That's the next piece of this. We will be doing a follow-up next week. I'm not ready to quite let that out yet.
You can't tell me everything about that?
I can't tell you everything, but we will have a follow-up that will actually air next Wednesday. And I believe it's going to air at probably 6 and 11 p.m. on Channel 9. We will be following up with that. But I do want to make it abundantly clear that the director of the lab and the employees who work there right now, the director told me, she said, I have some of my employees who they don't want to, they feel guilty about taking vacation because they know there's such a backlog and they feel for these victims and they want these cases to be able to be closed.
Well, Hillary Lake, thank you for joining us this afternoon. We'll look forward to the report next Wednesday. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Dan Hurley. Every medium has its strengths. Newspaper and magazines, print, allows readers to track details and statistics. Radio has the power to stimulate imaginations. And television, the image drives everything. Words support. A good TV reporter knows how to use those images to reveal emotion and character. Great reporters know how to leverage the strengths of their media to tell powerful stories. One of the great storytellers working in local TV over the last 31 years is Joe Webb. Earlier last week, Joe retired from Local 12 News. This afternoon, he joins us here on Cincinnati Edition. If you would like to join our discussion, you can call 513-419-7100 or email us at talk@wvxu.org. Joe, welcome to Cincinnati Edition.
Thank you,
Dan. I miss seeing you in the mornings.
Oh, well, I miss seeing you in the Local 12 newsroom. It was always a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Oh, this is great. Give me an example of a story that when you think about it, it still makes you smile that you did.
Oh my gosh! There are so many of them that make me smile. But you know, we did this thing when I was working at Channel 9, you know, almost 20 years ago, called the Hometown Series, and we just did countless stories that I look back on and make me smile. Dan, I really couldn't pick
so
one.
What makes a story a Joe Webb story?
Oh gosh, people. Mm-hmm. People and people who are willing to share their story, and that's, you know, so often in Cincinnati you find those people because people in Cincinnati just love Cincinnati and they love to talk about Cincinnati. And I think a Joe Webb story, I think, would be something that's about the city and about its history and about its quirks, and it's about those things because I always had fun with that. I didn't grow up here. But I got here and I loved it and embraced it.
I wonder if that was an advantage. You grew up in Oklahoma, right?
I did. And that was not often an advantage, more often a disadvantage, but I think it gave me a perspective that I could use to my advantage to help tell a story that might be a little bit different than what people were expecting.
So you were discovering, in a lot of cases, you were discovering the stories as you were doing them, and it wasn't just something you already knew about.
Absolutely, and that's what would make me smile. There you go. You elicited it. You got that out of me. Is a story where I learned something and where I got to satisfy my own curiosity about a place, a person, or a thing, or why we say, please, you know, those sorts of things.
Well, you know, that's – for me, that's always been – once you are a reporter, you can ask to go anywhere. And sometimes people let you go anywhere.
Oh, absolutely.
And, you know, I had always wanted to go to the top of the suspension bridge. And I was doing a documentary for Local 12 back in 1995. And I wanted to climb to the top of the – and we did. And it was focused on northern Kentucky. Usually the cameras are pointing the other way. So I wanted to point south. So we climbed the North Tower. And, you know, but I couldn't believe they let me up there.
Yeah. I've never been in the North Tower. Been on the South Tower.
Sure.
Been on the Kentucky
Everybody
side.
Everybody goes on the South Tower. Yeah. I wanted to go on the North Tower. So anyway, so why retire? I mean, compared to me, you're mid-career.
You know, oh, gosh, for a variety of reasons. I'm 63. I'll be 64 years old in November. And daily television news is really the work of young people. It really is a young person's business. There are some advantages to doing it well into your middle age. But, you know, the daily grind and the energy that it takes and the commitment that it takes is really something for young people. And it's like I found myself saying dozens of times over the last week, you know, I haven't been a young person for a long, long time. But that was, you know, that was one of the real motivators.
So the other side of that is, TV news being what it is, old people, older people,
sure,
like us, you end up in a newsroom with a lot of young people, and that gives you a lot of energy too. I mean, there's that side that
absolutely,
you know, sitting across
it keeps you young.
Yeah, sitting across from Bob Herzog. I mean, either drives you crazy or gives you a lot of energy. Right?
Well, it gave me a lot of energy. I love Bob, and I miss him dearly. He's one of the true giants of that newsroom, and one of the people that were a lot of fun. But yeah, you're right. The young people bring a lot of new ideas, and they bring a lot of new energy, and it does keep you young.
So this is a big, broad question.
Sure.
How has television news business and television news reporting changed over three decades?
Well, it's changed a great deal. Some of it for the better, but not all of it. You know, when I started in television news, we didn't have cell phones. We didn't have computers at our desks. We didn't have satellite trucks. There were just a lot of things that you have today, a lot of the technological things that you don't have. And so that's changed. And so news gathering has become a little bit easier because of all of the technological things. The one thing that, you know, social media has changed things a lot in the last few years, and the, you know, the conversations that we had to have, you know, about, hey, you know, you need to tweet more. You need to do more Facebook Lives. You need to post more on Facebook. Those conversations so often replaced what I thought were more substantive conversations about content and about how to develop a story and how to develop sources and how to you know, really do things and inform people. There were all of these discussions about this stuff that didn't matter much to me. And you know, I understand the significance of social media. It's very important in TV news. But, you know, a story is going to be defined by the people and the writing and the videography. It's not going to be defined by how many times I tweet about it during the course of a day. I mean, that's not going to make the story better. Will it draw people in to watch it? Maybe. I don't know. But
you know, one of the things you just ticked off a lot of the elements that go into a story. One thing that people may not fully realize is that a TV reporter is never working on their own. They're always working, certainly with that videographer, but producers and all sorts of other people. And that's what I learned so much. It's that videographer who they see things that I don't see. When you're looking through that lens,
oh, good,
they can focus.
And good videographers? Absolutely. And Local 12 has dozens
incredible.
Of – oh, the best. Maybe the best videography staff in the country. Certainly the best in the Midwest, and I think definitely the best in town. And, you know, when I hear people tell me – you know, and I've had a lot of people say a lot of nice things in the last week as I was leaving the business.
That'll change.
Yeah, it will. But so many things that people said specifically about stories that they liked were really elements that were brought to the table by the video, absolutely. Not by me.
Right.
And I think so many of the memorable things about my stories were things that were done by the photographer on that story. And I'm so grateful for that. And I worked with some great ones over the years. And, you know, my career – would not be what it was had it not been for great videographers, because they made a lot of the stories and a lot of mediocre stories they made great. I had nothing to do with it.
Yeah. You know, I think of somebody like somebody both of us know, Michael Benedict, who mm-hmm. was at Channel 12. Well, I taught Michael in high school. Then he taught me about TV when I started at 12. And now he's over at 9, and you worked with him over at 9. So he showed me so much. Every day. It was unbelievable.
And he's a brilliant videographer, a true problem solver, and a great guy to work with, a great collaborator.
You know, there's been a lot of speculation triggered by your retirement, and including some things that John Keyswetter has written here for WVXU, that what's going on in the Local 12 newsroom, and how much do all the retirements that have tumbled forward have to do with the new ownership, the Sinclair ownership. And how much of a factor was that in your decision?
Well, it was a factor. I'm not going to deny that. And, you know, I want to be real careful about what I say, because I really don't want to badmouth Local 12, because they were really good to me over the last 16 years. And there are a lot of great people there, a lot of great reporters, Jeff Hirsch, Anjanette Levy, Brad Underwood, Angela Ingram, still working there, a lot of great people. And so my experience with Local 12 and the people at 1906 Highland Avenue was very positive. And I want to make sure that I phrase everything I say, you know, and it's not directed at them. But when Sinclair Broadcast Group sent out that notice that everybody had to read, that, you know, Deadspin did the mashup of them that we've all seen, and that Rob Braun and Cammie Dierking, two people who I love dearly and who I have the greatest respect for as journalists and people, you know, were forced to read that like so many other anchors were, that got me to thinking. That was last spring. And, you know, I had some discussions with my own children about that who were like, what do you think about that? You know, what are you going to do? And I was under contract until September 27th. But I decided when that stuff happened that, you know, I had to leave at the end of my contract. I wanted to honor my contract. They had honored it on their end, paid me nicely, checks never bounced. And I have to tell you, nobody at corporate ever told me how to do a story or who to interview or what to do. But when that stuff transpired, I decided at that time that it was time to leave. That coupled with my age and the fact that, you know, I could do it.
Yeah. So what now?
You know, I'm going to teach a class at Xavier in the spring. I've got that lined up. I've got a couple of other things that I'm talking with people about that I haven't really firmed up. And so I'm going to take a few weeks off before I really start really hustling and exploring on those opportunities. I've got a class reunion back in Oklahoma, my 45th reunion next weekend. So I'm going to go back for that and see a lot of my old friends. And then when I return from that in a week, I'll really focus on what's next. I'm not ruling out working in television again. I love television. I love telling stories. I don't think I could go much longer without telling a story, writing a story. I've got to do that. And so we'll just have to see where that shakes out.
Do you think of yourself as a TV reporter, or do you think of yourself as a writer? I mean, you've been working in TV, and you certainly are a master at that, but there's a lot of other media, which I kind of tried to set up at the beginning of this. Could you imagine yourself sort of finding another medium?
Sure. I don't have, you know, I'm not going to rule anything out. I just like interviewing people, and I like talking to people and getting them to tell me their stories, and then telling their stories to other people. And I think that's really what reporters do, regardless of whether you work for in print, radio, or television. Sure. Oh, I think I have a skill set that could be used in all those areas. So we'll see.
Well, Joe Webb, thank you for being here today, for telling the stories of Cincinnatians with honesty and insight, and for making those of us who work with you better reporters and better people. And I say that very sincerely. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer for today's show is Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer is Selena Reeder. Segment producer is Layla Shikui. The technical director is Josh Elstro. Archives of our program are available on the website, wvxu.org. I'm Dan Hurley.